WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is Mark Matabane. He's written an autobiography about growing up in South Africa in the black township of Alexandra near Johannesburg. His family lived in a shack and was so poor they were sometimes reduced to eating weeds that grew near the outhouse, frying locusts, and scavenging for worms. His father was a tribalist who didn't want his son to learn English. His mother wanted him to get an education and send him to a tribal school. Matabane got high grades in school, but it was tennis that turned out to be his ticket out of South Africa. He was introduced to tennis by the white family that his grandmother worked for. After playing with the Black Tennis Association, he met Stan Smith, a white American professional tennis player who helped get Matabane a tennis scholarship in the United States. Matabane got a degree in economics from Dowling College on Long Island. He now lives in North Carolina, where he's working on another book. South Africa revoked his passport in 1981. Mark Matabane, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Before we talk about your life in America, let's talk about your life growing up in South Africa. Could I ask you to describe the home that you grew up in?
The ghetto where I lived was Alexandra, which was 1 square mile. With over 100,000 people, and many of these people lived in shacks. Our shack was 15 by 15 feet, and we slept on the floor on pieces of cardboard under the kitchen table, and often during bitter winter months, my mother would reinforce the one thin blanket we had with pieces of newspaper. The only twin bed in the house belonged to my father and mother and the latest infant sibling. We did get by with $10 a week that my father made as a menial laborer because he was denied other means of earning a living. But our problems were compounded by just the sheer terror of apartheid.
Well, one of the terrors that you experienced regularly growing up was the terror of the police raids. Mm-hmm. What was the purpose of the raids? What were they looking for when they'd come knocking on the door?
It was very confusing for a child to try and understand the brutality of the police because you expected them to protect you. But when they burst into our home, often after midnight or in the middle of the night, without a warrant, breaking down the doors and smashing windows, and then marching my parents naked out of bed and standing them in the middle of the room and interrogating them, I think that the trauma was so deep that you really felt naked terror. And it turned out that their problem was that they did not have a permit allowing them to live together as husband and wife, which is why they had to escape from their own home every day. And this permit was required in order to limit the number of black people within what is called white South Africa. So without these permits, obviously you could not live as a family. And so the raids were basically designed to tear the families apart.
And to exile whoever they could to the homelands.
Mm-hmm.
So you grew up in absolute fear that, that the police would come on the door and take your parents away, mm-hmm. or brutalize you and your brothers and sisters.
Mm. Yeah, they often took them away, and they would not tell you where they'd jailed them. I remember my father would often be away for months, and when he was away, we really experienced nightmares because he was the only breadwinner, and his being away meant that we had to scavenge for food in garbage dumps, or we had to go to the local abattoir and beg for gallons of cattle blood and come and boil it as soup and drink. Oftentimes we had nothing to eat, so we simply stared at each other and the empty pots and the sun going down. But we were lucky. We remained together. We had some roof over our heads. There were friends of mine, 5, 6, 7 years old, whose family had been torn apart, and they now lived on their own in scrapped cars and abandoned buildings, eating out of trash cans, and they were literally making it on their own.
How old were you when you realized that what you were experiencing had to do with this system of apartheid that white people in South Africa had created?
I think instinctively from the moment that I was born, because just under the conditions under which I was born, many black women in South Africa cannot afford maternity care. So they have to deliver babies under such difficult circumstances that many of them die either at childbirth or in their infancy from preventable diseases. And I survived a few, and I think that was my first encounter with apartheid, because South Africa has one of the best medical institutions in the world. It gave the world Christiaan Barnard in 1967. But it allows black people to just die like flies. So that was my first encounter. And I think as I grew up as a child, being cruelly robbed of my childhood, I never had any childhood, because from the moment I began to realize the brutality of the world around me, the crime, the poverty, the hatred and the anger, I was forced to act and think and feel like an adult. And that's a very heavy toll to exert on the sensibilities of a child.
It must have been very difficult for you when you first started meeting white people. The mm-hmm. first time you'd actually go into an area where there were whites, because as you explain in the book, whites were banned from the black townships without mm-hmm. without a permit to be there. And in that respect, they were almost allowed to remain ignorant of mm-hmm. how bad the conditions really were mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, that trend still continues today. Outsiders in America know more about blacks in South Africa than the average white South African knows of his own fellow people. But yes, I didn't see my first white suburb and meet the first white child till I was about 11 years old. And I remember I was so mortified at the thought of going into the white world, because my view of whites was conditioned by the movies, the violent movies which they fed us in the ghettos. So I envisioned this world full of terrible people, brutes. So when I went and realized that, my gosh, these people live literally in a paradise on earth, because they had paved roads, they had mown lawns, flowers, huge houses. I remember asking my grandmother, that who does that house belong? It was like an average suburban house. And she said that it belonged to one family. And then I imagined that that very same house back home was partitioned to house over 100 people. I think I began to see the disparities. And of course, to me, that trip made me feel like I'd made a leap into another galaxy, so to speak.
Mark Marabane is my guest, and he's written an autobiography about growing up in a black township in South Africa, and his book is called Kaffir Boy. You grew up speaking a tribal language, and your father, the way you explained it in your book, mm-hmm. wanted you to only speak that, and he didn't mm-hmm. really want you to learn English, whereas your mother mm-hmm. really hoped that education would help you get out of mm-hmm. the kind of conditions you'd grown up in. Can you tell us a little bit about what the school was like that you went to, the tribal mm-hmm. school?
Yes, it was like a chamber of horrors, but the horrors began before I enrolled in school, when my mother would get up at 3 a.m. for 6 months and go to the police station to ask for that piece of paper without which I could not enroll at this tribal school. Well, I finally got there, but there was no money for the primers, which cost about 20 cents, and for the uniform, because black education is inferior and not compulsory. And so we had to do some deciding. You use 20 cents to buy me a primer and we starve for a day, or we eat for a day and I don't have the book. Well, my father felt that it had to be the latter. We had to eat, and school, he didn't care about it. But my mother insisted that I go to school, and she would take a penny here and a penny there and buy me the books. And of course, she would be involved in huge fights with my father, because as he was being emasculated by the system and his sense of humanity twisted, he began to turn against people he loved the most. And he became such an alcoholic, he gambled, and he abused his own family. So he fought my mother every step of the way when she said, he must be educated. He said, no, this is my son, he won't be. And my mother was an illiterate. She never went to school, yet she had this incredible vision to somehow believe that an education could make a difference for me. And she sacrificed so much. I mean, she was suffering under triple oppression as a black, as an illiterate, and as a woman. But even with her own battles, she found time to say to me that, especially when the going got rough, when I came back home whipped black and blue, crying and say, what's the use of all this? You know, she would always say that, you know, child, always have hope. Things will get better. You know, always believe in yourself, that this is a good thing. You will see it eventually.
This reminds me of something that you mentioned in your autobiography, that you'd go to school, and although you really enjoyed learning and were very excited by books, mm-hmm. you'd sometimes say to yourself, what's this education for? What mm-hmm. am I going to be allowed to do with it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that that questioning was reinforced by what I saw happening around me. Educated black people ended up picking up garbage cans and they really almost did nothing. And obviously the reason was that this education, which was in many ways indoctrination to make us better slaves, was really breeding within us some of these attitudes that apartheid wanted us to have.
You ended up learning tennis, which ended up being your mm-hmm. ticket out of South Africa. You were introduced to it through the white family that your grandmother worked for.
Mm-hmm.
What interested you in tennis when you first found out about the sport?
I guess it was from boredom that I became interested in tennis. I had played soccer, I had been involved in street gangs, I had seen many of my friends killed. And when I made that visit to the white suburb and saw these people play this rather dainty game, I said, well, let me take it up as a challenge. And I got my first warped tennis racket and took it back to the ghetto and began pounding against the brick wall. And before I knew it, I heard of an American named Arthur Ashe, and just following his exploits in the tennis world made him the first true positive role model I'd ever had. And I think my understanding of him was that maybe he had become this good in tennis because, rather, he had become this free as a black man and confident of himself through tennis. So I associated tennis with freedom. And of course, I read of his life, and I knew that he had grown up in the South during the heydays of Jim Crow, and that he had so many obstacles to overcome, the most important which were, you know, just dealing with his own hatred and bitterness and anger, and that he had transcended all these and emerged very proud of himself and successful as a human being. I said, maybe if I, you know, he presented a challenge to me, and I wanted to do the same.
There were some interesting conflicts that were posed for you when you started to play tennis. You played mm-hmm. with the Black Tennis Association in South mm-hmm. Africa, and they boycotted matches that whites mm-hmm. participated in.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some of those matches that you wanted to play in because mm-hmm. it was the way that you could kind of get out, really.
Mm-hmm.
But you ended up being banned by the Black Tennis Association for mm-hmm. participating in matches that whites played in.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to go against the Black Tennis Association and play in those matches?
Mm, yeah, good question. I think that fundamental to my decision to follow that rather very awkward and often deadly route was that I had come a long way from the days when I was consumed with anger and hatred and didn't know what to do with them. And having met through tennis some of the few whites who exist in South Africa who were prepared to accept me as a human being and as an equal, I felt that to pretend that they don't exist would be to deny something very fundamental in myself. And so I decided that even though the pressure is enormous to dissociate from these people, that for my own sense of self, and for my own continued resiliency as a human being, I just had to make sure that I was very faithful to these friendships. And that is why I often found myself at loggerheads with the more angry, and justifiably angry, because they had never had the opportunities to meet these few individuals, but I had. And I knew that I could never go back to the days when I felt that there was absolutely no good white person on this earth.
It must have been a very difficult decision to make, because mm-hmm. on the one hand, you could have stood with the Black Tennis Association mm-hmm. in solidarity for the larger issues. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you stood a better chance in bettering your life mm-hmm. by continuing to play tennis, even mm-hmm. in white matches. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you see, I was very young. All these momentous decisions had to be made while I was 15 years old.
That is very
young. And yet I somehow believed that if I survived this nightmare, if tennis took me somewhere, and I desperately wanted it to take me to a place where I could have some freedom to feel and understand what it meant to be a human being, that I would be able to take upon me a much more important duty, which is to tell the world exactly what is going on in South Africa, how the system leads brother to fight against brother and sister to fight against sister by putting them in the same awkward situation that you just described. And I think that in a way, I was lucky to have made it here and to have written a book like that and explaining the same incident that you just mentioned.
Are you reconciled with the Black Tennis Association now?
Oh, certainly I am. In fact, I think in many ways they're very happy that I came over here, because I've been able to get people to recognize the enormous talent that is in the ghetto and the determination of these young black boys and girls to succeed despite the odds. And I think that the world knowing of the black children of Alexandra has led to the world responding. And I think that that's a positive thing.
I'd like to talk about your life since you've come to America, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Mark Matabane, who's written an autobiography about growing up in a black township in South Africa. The book is called Kaffir Boy. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Mark Matabane is my guest, author of the bestseller Kaffir Boy. When you decided to accept a scholarship, a tennis scholarship in America, was it difficult to think about leaving your family behind in South Africa? It's a funny thing. I think it's a typical bond for a lot of families who send their first person, the first mm-hmm. person in the family goes to school, and through mm-hmm. the education, they leave the family, mm-hmm. and the family never knows if they'll return or not.
Mm. Yeah, it was so difficult that I often didn't want to think about it, because I knew that I was not leaving them in a safe place, that I had become a breadwinner in a way because I had a job, and that if I left, they would tumble back into the same pit of suffering and poverty where I thought I'd pull them out of. But I knew I had to leave. I knew that I had to go to a land where at least I could have some freedom to think, to act, and to feel just like a human being ought to feel and think and act. So I left, and my mother, as always, was the one to encourage me to do that. She said, this hasn't all happened for nothing. There is a reason why you have to go to America. But what you should remember is that wherever you go, always believe in yourself. Never allow other people to define your own sense of humanity. And I think I came with those values. And she said the third thing, that you only fail if you stop trying. So those three maxims remained with me when I left. And of course, I had, like every other foreigner, thought America to be a utopia. And when I came here, I realized that there was indeed freedom. There was indeed opportunity. You know, but that alongside these wonderful things were there was an American tragedy. There was a hideous nightmare which afflicted people of color, people of a different sex, and that these people were subjected to the same degradation and humiliation and hopelessness and hatred and anger that I thought I had left in South Africa. Now, it was very frightening finding yourself alone in a land which you had thought was paradise, and then you see that alongside this paradise there is a sort of apartheid existing.
I'm trying to imagine what it was like for you when you first came to America, which is, of course, a difficult thing for me to imagine. But I'd guess that a very difficult thing for you to figure out was how to relate to white people in America, since the image you had of white people was in South Africa, and most but not all of the white people there were upholders of the apartheid system. Was it difficult to get a grasp of how to size up white Americans?
No, not really. And I think that the reason has to do with the first white American I ever met, Stan Smith, because he represented so much of what is good in America.
This is the tennis pro who helped you get the scholarship to come to America.
There we met just out of the blues, and yet he had the confidence and the broad-mindedness to just accept me for what I was. Now, all the South Africans I'd known, whites, even my best friends, never had that that openness that he did. And that was very important, because even when I came to America and found out that there were the same bigots, the same mental attitudes among some whites that I thought I'd left in South Africa, there was always that hope that there are more people like Stan Smith. But I wasn't quite prepared for some of the devastation that I encountered in the black ghettos of this country, like Harlem, like the south side of Chicago, and many other places. Because there I saw, American children, suffering the same, traumas that apartheid children suffered. Having the same anger and hatred and bitterness bred in them. And what was frightening was that it seemed that the whole society was oblivious to this.
What happened to tennis? It was tennis that got you the scholarship to America. Did you continue with it once you came?
Yes, I continued with it, but I just realized 2 years into my degree that maybe it was meant to be a passport to freedom, but not my end in life. Because I then realized that, first of all, education here was not prescribed by the government, that you could read any book you wanted, that you not only could you read, but you could write what you felt and thought. So to me, that was much more provocative. And I felt that at least I ought to try to begin expressing what I so deeply felt, my convictions and my beliefs. And one of them is this undying faith in an education.
A kind of strange twist to your story that many of our listeners might already know about and might have witnessed part of is that Oprah Winfrey, the television talk show host, managed to bring your brothers and sisters and your parents to America to visit with you and filmed the reunion and had the rest of your family on her show with you and with her. That must have been such a very kind of shocking situation for your family to have a television host fly them over to America.
Yeah, it was. We had been separated almost 9 years, and there were some of my siblings that were mere toddlers when I left. But when they came to America, I think they captured the essence of America, the freedom, the opportunity that pervades the air, especially to somebody who's been sweltering under the heat of oppression. And my mother summed it up by saying that she thought she had arrived in Canaan. She's very religious. And I think that they immediately realized the big difference between South Africa and America, which is embodied in the fact that here at least you have certain ideals which you strive after, and that usually what disappoints America is that there is a lack of collective will to get better, to progress. Whereas in South Africa, we have nothing to look forward to. The whole law, the whole constitution, the ideals we subscribe to are those of segregation today, segregation forever.
Your brothers and sisters stayed in America, the way I understand it, and your parents, because of, I guess, passport issues, had to go back to South Africa?
Yes, we had left other people behind who could not get their papers on time to accompany the whole family. But two of my sisters, the youngest, got to stay, and my brother, because I insisted, rather explained to them the importance of getting an education, and that probably they would have the best education because they were so determined to learn in America. And fortunately, that worked out in the, in public school.
What would you like to do? Do you want to stay in America or return to South Africa?
Well, I guess that there is so, for me, I can't say this people in general, but there is so much freedom for me that I feel that for the time being, given what I've chosen to do as my duty and as my career writing, that I would like to remain here, because at least I can tell the world about South Africa, about the human tragedy that is taking place there.
Your book is a bestseller. Are you able to send money to your parents in South Africa?
Yeah, even before it was a bestseller, I scrounged around to send them some money to not only have something to eat, but to also ensure that my siblings stayed in school.
Oh, one last question. I know when you left, the government was initially reluctant to give you a passport out. And they said, you're just going to come to America and you're going to criticize apartheid. Mm-hmm. And you said, no, you really wanted to study tennis. But after you were here for a while, you did really start speaking out against apartheid. We only have a few seconds. Were you afraid to do that initially, afraid that there'd be some kind of reprisals against you or your family?
Yes, I was, just for a moment. And then I decided to do it. And there were reprisals. Two of my brothers-in-laws were murdered by the police because of my activism. But I just knew that there was just a greater issue here, that my freedom and my safety were important, but not all important. The freedom and the safety of the whole nation of South Africa was of uppermost importance.
And your passport is revoked, which means you couldn't go back now.
Yes, but that's a small price to pay, really, for the freedom and opportunity that I've had.
I regret we don't have more time to talk. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Mark Marabane has been my guest, and he's written an autobiography about growing up in a black township in South Africa. The autobiography is called Kaffir Boy, and it's published by New American Library. Marabane now lives in the United States. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.